You are listening to episode 2 of the Secret Origins podcast Redux, featuring the origin of Robot Man. Welcome to the Secret Origins podcast, a review show dedicated to the Secret Origins comics published by DC in the 1980s. We are your guest hosts, Siskoid
and Bess.
And this is a part of a Patreon unlocked reward for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Your pledges have made it possible to extend the run of Ryan Daly's long-finished Secret Origins podcast with other origin books. And today we're talking about All-Star Squadron number 63's Secret Origin of Robot Man. Secret Origins was an anthology series published by DC Comics, with each issue telling the origin of at least one hero or villain from the DC Universe. It ran for 50 issues between January of 1986 and June of 1990, plus three annuals and a special. What that doesn't tell you is that it was writer Roy Thomas's baby and was meant as a companion book to his All-Star Squadron, showcasing a Golden Age character in almost every issue. And that when the crisis on Infinite Earths screwed up Roy's plans for Earth 2, the book sort of became a lame duck, and Roy used it to print even more Secret Origins stories, which might have been originally designed to print in Secret Origins, or could have been directly made for All-Star Squadron. It's hard to say. The issue we've chosen is one of about a half dozen such issues, titled The Origin of the Golden Age Robot Man. It's by Roy Thomas, with art by Mike Baer and inker Mike Macklin. Bass, was this a character you already liked, or are you more like a Doom Patrol Robot Man fan, or what's the deal with Robot Man for you?
You know what? I didn't even know there was a Robot Man back then. I only knew Cliff Steele. I didn't know about this one.
Yeah, so it's a discovery for you.
Yeah. It's 100% a discovery. You know, I was kind of used to Cliff Steele actually while reading the comics. So I started off with that Brooklyn accent, but it quickly just went away.
I mean, who knows what accent he actually has, but he has like this posh mansion. So maybe he's more of a posh, like New England.
I'm thinking even the way even the words he's using in the comic, I mean, you know, he has this maybe a little bit more sophisticated.
In the Silver Age, when they were reinventing heroes and bringing back names, not many people think of Robot Man as one of those. But yeah, you know, Robot Man was I won't say a prominent Golden Age hero, but he did have a lot of stories. He was published for a long time, as we'll see.
Great character, great idea, especially for, you know, this guy is in the timeline early 1940s. So a Robot Man would have been incredible sci-fi.
Like for me, I really discovered the character in the 80s when he was a member of All-Star Squadron. And he was, you know, one of my favorite members because I think Roy Thomas paid special attention to him. It's like, well, there's the characters from the JSA. We're not going to use them so much because they've had so much exposure. So he really catered to different characters to be like the All-Star Squadron core, Tarantula and Robot Man and Fire, you know, some new characters like Firebrand and Amazing Man. But definitely Robot Man was one of the main figures in that team. Yeah. And I think all the ones that he really catered to in that series sort of became my favorites from the Golden Age, him and Our Man and Dr. Fate was in it a lot. So Robot Man for me was that character. And then I went back and I think I have like a Golden Age stories collection here. And there is one Robot Man story in it. I was so surprised to see how Robot Man was more cartoony back in the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends on the strip. It wasn't necessarily didn't start that way, but at some point it became very like, you know, more like Plastic Man or more like Captain Marvel, where the opponents were more cartoony and felt more like a humor strip in a way. I do have some interest in Golden Age characters no matter what. I wonder, is like the robot, like the human robot, the humanish robot, kind of a trope you enjoy in other works?
Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, one of my favorite, well, he's not exactly a robot, he's a cyborg, but Cyborg is one of my favorites of all time. I mean, he's more than just a brain inside a metal shell, but Yeah, I think we're on the fence of saying, yeah, he's at least part robot. But yeah, I do enjoy sentient robots or, you know, people brains inside robots. I do really enjoy that because it, once again, it's one of those things that feels like weird sci-fi from the past, you know?
I mean, even in our more recent past, yeah, I remember seeing Short Circuit, you know, when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
That's like the humanish robot. I know I've been very dismissive of characters like Red Tornado.
Well, I can't blame you.
Yeah, even the Vision is not really my cup of tea, but they're very similar characters.
Well, it's because they have this Pinocchio complex where they want to be a real person.
Data.
Yeah, exactly. I think I prefer the robots who really are robots.
And those guys are obviously the ones I mentioned there are actual robots or androids or synthezoids or whatever they want to call them. But the person stuck inside the metal shell, whether that's like partial, like cyborg or, you know, Robot Man's actually a cyborg because he's got a human component inside.
Yeah, big time.
The two Robot Men that we know. There is something about alienation and feeling disconnected from people. And I think Doom Patrol really went that way with more psychological work. I think even in the 60s. For the Robot Man of the Golden Age, his actual stories were a bit more fanciful and a little less psychologically complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but Roy Thomas tried to give it a certain psychology that we'll see in the book that we're going to cover, because by then it's the 80s and people expect that. But the original stories, I don't think he was much, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm a robot now. You know?
Yeah, basically that's what it is.
It's not quite that, but it wasn't like traumatic. And by Cliff Steele, certainly the Cliff Steele we know from later Doom Patrol stories, it was traumatic. It really was problematic for him to be essentially a brain in a jar, but the jar could walk around.
Yeah.
Okay, let's look at the publication history of this character. As the story goes, and I'm going by Roy Thomas's text piece at the back of the comics. This was a very important part of Secret Origins, and it was a very important part of All-Star Squadron as well. When National Comics, part of the entity we now know as DC Comics, was looking to expand in 1941 and start a seventh book, The Powers That Be went to Jerry Siegel. He co-created Superman and the Spectre for them. So, you know, give us some new characters. The comic was called Star Spangled Comics and would star the Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy, which Jerry Siegel gave them, who I guess they didn't really prove their sales driving worth because even though the characters stuck around for a long time and, you know, they're basically the basis for Stargirl, which now has a show. But by issue 7, they were replaced by, they were still in the book, but they were replaced by Simon and Kirby's Newsboy Legion as the cover feature. And that issue, cover dated April 1942, also introduced a new Siegel creation, Robot Man. That's why we're here. There are some contradictions as to who co-created the character. Roy seems to think, in 1986, that the origin story was by Joe Shuster and Ed Dobrotka. But more contemporary sources credit that first story's art to Schuster's assistants, Leo Novak and Paul Cassidy, who also did their share of Superman's stories. So that original story does have a very Schuster-esque look, like the faces are very like, look like Superman, but these were artists that were working under him and aping his style. So maybe this is a little bit of a Bob Kane didn't really draw it kind of situation. I think Roy was working from sources that he had then. I think now, information available now is probably more credible. We've had, you know, decades of research to check into this. It doesn't mean Schuster didn't work on the character's design with his Superman partner, Jerry Siegel, but he didn't draw the story, it seems. Anyway, Robot Man appeared in Star Spangled from issue 7, which, by the way, also introduced TNT and Dan the Dynamite, ooh, to issue 82. Then he jumped to Detective Comics from 138 to number 202, cover dated December of 1953, skipping over only one issue of that. So that actually gives him the record for longest lasting back page hero at DC.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of Robot Man stories, in other words, are out there. And most of them have that more cartoony look and lighter tone, I think. His greatest enemy, I guess, was Captain Compass, because that's the character that replaced him in Star Spangled Comics. And then Captain Compass moved to Detective Comics to replace him again, which is a better place for Captain Compass because he's like a detective of the seven seas kind of character. But it's like every time Captain Compass moves in, Robot Man leaves. And then in the Silver Age, there was a new Robot Man created for the Doom Patrol, Cliff Steele, as you said. He's now a TV star as well. But this Robot Man was one of the main heroes featured in All-Star Squadron in the early to mid-80s. And then there was a Whatever Happened To backup strip in DC Comics Presents that gave him an ending. Like his brain ends up in the aged body of his former assistant, Grayson, that is in the origin story. It's a weird ending for him, but they were kind of trying to give all these old Golden Age heroes some sort of ending in, you know, in a matter of, I don't know, 6 pages or something. So that's kind of how it ended for him. And it hasn't really been, you know, if you do like flashbacks to the Golden Age, that's when you might see this character. But otherwise, that was the end for him.
Oh, well, he did have a nice run, though.
A very healthy run. It surprised me when I did the research.
Yeah.
So we'll take a short promo break right now. And when we come back, we'll look at the actual issue, All-Star Squadron number 63.
The Justice League wouldn't help him, so Batman formed a new team. These people of power are all looking for something, be it their past, or a purpose, or simply somewhere to fit in. These are the heroes for a troubled age. They are the Outsiders.
We are the Outsiders. Oh, we are the Outsiders.
Covering Mike W. Barr's 1983 series from the very beginning, as they face villains no other team can, like Agent Orange, the Force of July, and the Nuclear Family. Puns. This is The Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast. Look for us with The Huntress podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Or listen at our website, thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter at BatOutcasters. We are The Outcasters, because to live outside the law, you must be honest.
We're back. We're looking at All-Star Squadron number 63, cover dated November of 1986. So it's right during the Secret Origins run. So I feel like this is very much a part of it. A story that Roy just couldn't fit into the main series, so he used his space in All-Star Squadron to show it. Let's talk about that cover. What do you think of this cover by Bear? You like it?
I kind of do. It has this pinup quality to it. We see a somewhat deconstructed Robot Man on a work table type thing where he's being worked on and the brain is not inside the skull yet. And he always looked like he has a smile. So that's kind of a positive thing, but it is kind of reminiscent of, you know, all the background is all in purple or a darker color, and it's very Kirby-esque.
All the tech.
Yeah, it's all weird tech that we don't know what it is, but we understand it's tech. The color kind of surprised me because, like I said, I only knew Cliff Steele who has this bronzy type color. This Robot Man has a silverish, bluish tone to him. So I was like, ooh, this is new. But I really do actually enjoy this cover. It would have been a cover that I would have probably picked up.
As I did originally. So, but to me, it's like this one, I guess he's, Mike Bear is inking himself because it does look different from the inside. And I think like the weakest thing about the comic is the lack of the metal sheen that is in Macklin's inks. I think like the inks are a little bit rough and don't make the tech look shiny, but the cover, it's like I think it's very well defined. It's very shiny. The tech is very geometrical. And then when you look in the issue itself, same artist, but the way the inking works, it's much looser, I guess. So you still have a lot of geometric shapes because Mike Bear likes to do like interesting panel shapes and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I always felt a little more sketchy to me. And a lot of All-Star Squadron in this era look very sketchy. I felt like the inks were not doing the art the best service, let's say. And I think this cover kind of exemplifies that.
I mean, honestly, the lines are kind of thin. All that inking detail, it isn't really quite there, but the cover is a lot better than the actual comic. Yeah,
I always felt like Mike Baer was working, like, he does like Art Deco kind of things, but I felt like it would have worked better in a bigger size. But it feels like he crams so much in there, and if the inks are kind of loose, then you lose a lot of detail, especially with the color processes of the time.
And if the characters are smaller, you know, once in a while we have these smaller characters, they are pretty much just sketches. You understand who they are, but you see no real detail. Thank God this wasn't in the digital age, where you kind of always need that detail. Back then, I guess, we kind of... we were fine with it.
Let's do a story synopsis here. As told from the 1941 Journal of Dr. Robert Crane, that fateful night, Dr. Crane and his assistant, Chuck Grayson, were working late on their experiment when Crane's fiancée, Joan Carter, came to the door. He'd forgotten their date and she slaps him and is on her way, not noticing the gangsters coming up the mansion grounds. They invade the house with guns, fatally shoot Crane, knock out Grayson, and find an inert robot. Not realizing the worth of their find, they race off before the cops are alerted, thinking their operation is a bust. Grayson comes to and sees only one option to help his friend survive, transplanting his brain in the robot body. Of course.
That's the only option.
That's the only option. Meanwhile, the crooks, afraid Grayson could still identify them, make an anonymous phone call to the police, implicating him in the crime. And it's hard to prove Bob Crane is alive when his body is shot up and his brain has been removed from his skull. Grayson allows himself to be arrested from fear of the cops doing something to the robot that could indeed kill his still inert friend. Crane wakes up hours later in a robot body and is at first distraught at his loss of humanity. But then he grabs the morning paper from his doorstep and realizes his assistant's been accused of his murder, so he springs into action. But his appearance makes it hard to catch a cab, and later he's chased by the police, who seem intent on proving Robot Man is bulletproof. He races back home, from where he learns to tune in to radio broadcasts with his robot ears. He's still a scientific genius, so he sits down in his lab and creates a lifelike mask, a whole human disguise, in fact, and sets off to free his friend from the charges. He tells people his hollow voice is the result of a childhood accident, and in an identity he calls Paul Dennis, he visits Grayson in jail and reveals himself to him. They discuss how he might be exonerated. Later, at his own funeral, Crane talks to Joan. They take a cab back together. It gets in an accident, and the angry truck driver, who wasn't looking where he was going, punches Paul Dennis in the face and hurts his hand, which impresses Joan. Remembering one of the attackers was called Flip, Paul Dennis, amateur detective, goes into some kind of low-life club asking questions. He intimidates informants as the unusually strong Paul, but tracks Flip down as Robot Man. Crane makes Flip call the rest of the gang to his hotel room, where Robot Man makes quick work of them, all except Mason, the gang leader and his murderer, who escapes. Robot Man jumps out the window and into Mason's car, crashing the thing and capturing Mason, who is then forced to admit his crime to the governor. The Robot Man goes right to the top. Grayson is freed, and Crane talks him into helping him fight crime as Robot Man. So that's the origin, and I gotta tell you, Bass, I tracked down a scan of the original story from Star Spangled, number 7.
Ooh, nice.
And it's very close.
Oh, really?
Well, if you're wondering, why that bit where there's a car accident?
Yeah.
Why do we need that? It's in the original story. So Roy, very, very nerdy comic book fan, uses a lot of even the same dialogue. So people exclaim things, it's like very often it's taken from the original story. What I got the feeling from it is that Mike Baer, the artist, was not shown the original story. So he was free, or maybe he just ignored it, but he was free to do what he wanted. So people aren't dressed the same, like that strange 40s outfit that Joan is wearing on the night of the date.
Yeah.
Like it's like this parka dress or whatever. Like she's not wearing that in the original story. So she looks more like a Lois Lane or something. He uses a lot of the stuff and then he adds to it to give it more psychology or to talk about more powers that Robot Man has that we know. That All-Star Squadron showed us he had, but maybe in the original story, you didn't have radio ears yet, you know? So he adds to that, but ultimately, it's like beat for beat, very much the original story.
Oh, wow. Wow. Once again, I did not know that, but it's great that the original story was used as a canvas to, you know, buff it up and make it a complete story with, like you said, more psychology in there, more explanation also. I really did like some of the... The thing is, it looks like something drawn in the 80s, but is a reference to the 40s.
Okay, what?
Like that costume. The costume that Joan has.
The green one, you mean?
Yeah, green one. If somebody from the 40s drew a lady in a fancy outfit from the 40s, you probably wouldn't see that. But this looks like haute couture for the 40s. So, you know, if somebody was to do a little bit of research in the 80s, trying to look back at the 40s, you would probably see some like this and go, oh, well, I guess that's what people in the 40s wore if they were fancy or something. But it probably wasn't.
Yeah, maybe he's, you know, I don't know. Mike Baer is at this point drawing All-Star Squadron, which means, you know, it's a comic in the 40s. So he's probably using a lot of reference work, maybe old movies.
Yeah.
And different things are catching his eye. But obviously, like the original artist, whether it's, I guess it was Novak, not Schuster, but, you know, in that style, maybe just going for something a lot simpler. They're not like,
yeah.
You know, they're more likely to just, okay, this is my stock woman's outfit or evening wear look, and that's what I'm doing. And they're not using reference. They're not really thinking in terms of, oh, what is in fashion right now? You know, it's just,
yeah.
It's just a Joe Blow working on comics in some back room somewhere, you know, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a more fancy way of showing the 40s because now there's research to it. Whereas if you're living in the 40s, you're just drawing from life or you're just very simply, you know, buildings all look the same kind of. You're not really thinking in terms of, oh, I gotta reference this particular dress or this particular building or this particular look.
Exactly. No, nobody draws for archives. Everybody draws for right now. You know, that's the kind of the weird thing about, well, it's not weird. It's actually enjoyable. I enjoy that kind of stuff. You know, like the police officer with the complete outfit, you know, with the real hat, and he looks like he's going to be in a parade, you know, but that's not the work outfit of a police officer, you know?
I'm not sure what it was back then, you know, and I mean, there is also, you know, you've got also Roy Thomas, who is very much a historian kind of writer who is using a lot of reference for even for the writing. So, for example, like here they say they were going to like the date in the original comic. It was unspecified. But in this, they're saying they were going to the theater to see Arsenic and Old Lace, which is a Cary Grant movie.
Yeah.
And I've never seen – I was thinking – and this is not in the original story. So I'm thinking, okay, why – and it's Roy Thomas, so he's already decided, and he says so in the text piece, he's decided that because he needed, this is very nerdy of him, but because he needed Robot Man to be in All-Star Squadron, he decided that the story would take place, you know, like there's a mention of Halloween was yesterday.
Yeah.
So the story takes place in October, November of 1941, even though the comic came out in 42. And this is the nerdiness of it, is that he wanted the characters to show up kind of in order of when they first appeared. So he wouldn't use a character that only appeared later.
Oh.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So in Robot Man's case, he really wanted to be in there, and there was enough cues, I guess, in the original story to say that they were told from, okay, we're telling them in 42, but maybe they happened at the end of 41. And that's how he got Robot Man in the team from the get-go. Fine. He's so nerdy. I'm thinking, well, did Arsenic and Old Lace come out that week? You know, it's like he researched what movies were out on the week of Halloween 1941. Oh, yeah. And that's why he chose it. Because I've never seen it, even though I am a Cary Grant fan, but there's a problem with rights in Canada.
Really?
With certain movies. And many Cary Grant movies, there's some Cary Grant movies and there's some like Marilyn Monroe movies, and it's like it's very specific that these movies cannot be shown. I watch TCM a lot, Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
And sometimes like Arsenic and Old Lace is often on the schedule. You know, when you tune in Canada, sometimes they replace movies because there's a rights issue. And Arsenic and Old Lace is one of them. Just can't see it on TCM.
Oh, my.
So I don't know what that's all about. But a lot of Cary Grant movies are like this. For some reason, no idea why. In this case, I had to look up the plot and see, well, maybe the plot has something to do with Robot Man in some way. And it is about, there's like, it's a little bit like How to Lose a Man in 10 Days or kind of,
okay,
kind of plot. But there's also, Cary Grant's aunt has, they bury lonely men in their cellar. They're just like this dark, the arsenic part, I guess. But so I don't know what that is all about, but is it a reference to the body in the cellar, the body in the laboratory? Is it that? So I don't know. If people have seen Arsenic and Old Lace, is there a link? You know, do you see the link? Let us know. If it's Roy Thomas, it's probably more of a historical detail.
Pinpointing, you know, that's very nerdy, actually. Very, very nerdy.
Just breaking in real quick, after verifying IMDb, it appears Arsenic and Old Lace was only released in September of 1944, almost 3 years after these events. So obviously, Roy Thomas didn't have access to IMDb. So there goes that theory.
But it's the kind of stuff we enjoy, though, right?
Well,
I mean, I enjoy the hell out of this stuff.
It depends on the person, because I've heard the critique that Roy Thomas, his comics are so dense, especially these ones. They're so dense because he has to stop the action to info dump about history, you know, and how this is an actual historical detail. And, you know, put a lot of, let's put some captions in here and have characters talk about it and have characters, you know, reference movies and politics of the time because he wants to show his research. And it's true. Yeah. I've read that. But to me, it doesn't feel modern as a style of writing. But I did enjoy those comics in part for that reason. For me, it was a history lesson in world history, but also primarily in comics history.
I'm one of those who enjoys it. But if I was to read only that all the time, I'd probably get bored of it. But when it happens once in a while, like in this comic, I enjoy the hell out of it.
Now, let's look at the like parts of this story. Okay, so there's the whole beginning and then, you know, the robot wakes up later. And and this is much more expanded from the original story. In the original story, there are some parts of it. I like, you know, like the like his knees creak. Mm-hmm. That's in the original as well. But it's like basically the only my body isn't human anymore kind of here is like he's noticing his voice. You know, it's like he's waking up very slowly and it's like he's got a clock in his head. And what did you think of this sequence? It's like the waking up in the robot body. And how does it compare to Cliff Steele, the stories that you did know?
Actually, I didn't think of Cliff Steele in this moment when I was reading. I was thinking more along the lines of Frankenstein's monster. Mm. You know, it kind of feels like a Frankenstein's monster awakening type thing, but he's not a dead person's brain inside a flesh. He's a very scientific, very smart man inside a metal body. So how he wakes up, I really enjoyed it. It was very movie-like. Even the shots still respect how movies work. Because once in a while in the comics, they cross that axis. I did enjoy in part because it has this wonderful and unique to comic books special effects to them. You know, we have this weird Kirby crackly looking stuff all around all the time. We have these expression lines coming out of, we still know that we're in that lab, but we don't need to show the lab all the time. We see like the senses coming alive. And I really dug it. I enjoyed how he's all not coordinated at the beginning. He falls, he stumbles, he's trying to understand these new sensations because he's still a brain, right? Inside this metal carcass, this metal man, you know, his reaction to seeing himself was still kind of weird. Because he knew this robot, he built this robot, but when he saw himself in the mirror, he was like, no! I guess that's the reaction we need to have when we're not in our body. When there's a brain transfer, that's what we should do, because that's what movies told us to do.
They do mention at the beginning that they were like at the, I don't know if they ever thought of, I guess they must have thought at some point that they could put a brain in there, but they were just at the step where they were at. In their experiments was just activating the body as a robot, you know, it wasn't maybe like a remote control kind of thing or something, just activating it to see if its systems would work. And that little leap to, oh, and we can also put a human brain in there and plug it in is it's a bit of a, okay, science fiction craziness there, comic book craziness.
Yeah.
And maybe he's just surprised that it's like it takes him a long time to realize that that's what's happening. It's like,
yeah,
his brain doesn't want to believe it, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's what would happen, right? We wouldn't want to believe that we're looking at our own reflection. So I guess that's okay. It's just that, you know, I was like, yeah, you built that robot. I mean, if you don't like the look, you should have done something earlier. But then he quickly, like a lot of superheroes, especially the older type superheroes, he gets into action very quickly, you know, and he discovers that not only he can move and he can feel things or sense things, but that he has superhuman abilities. And every time I see somebody, because he gets bonked on the head a couple times, and that's the only thing that kind of hurts him. And, well, that's kind of funny because, you know, if you're going to put a brain in something, at least put a little bit of padding somewhere.
But even so, is it like our brains are in something and it's like it's concussions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he gets bullets in the head. It's,
yeah, the cop is kind of trigger happy on this. Well, but I guess history never changes.
No.
But really did enjoy that discovery of the new senses, the new reality. I mean, of course, it goes quickly. It's a 24-page comic book. I mean, you can't, the discovery could be a series all its own.
It was even shorter in the original, obviously. And
of course.
And, but it still had, and I guess this is why this is in here. Fine, discovering your abilities, although you built the robot body, you should know a little bit more about its capabilities. Trying to hail down a cab and the cop and all of that stuff was in the original as well. And then he returns home. What is this interlude that doesn't really serve a purpose story-wise, except self-discovery? It's in the original story, so it's here as well. And then when he gets home, there's like this other part of the character that is maybe more ludicrous, very comic booky, where despite having this big metal body, he can disguise himself as human. And he has time, like that night, to basically create a lifelike mask for himself. He doesn't make a mask of his former self because the cops have his body in the morgue. So that would, it's not like, no, I'm still alive. We got your body right here. You know, so he creates another identity and he can, you know, Roy Thomas tries to explain things more than the original story.
Yeah.
Like, good thing Joan buys me the wrong size of shoes.
That's just a happy coincidence, I guess.
Yeah, but you're still in a robot body that was earlier creaking and you've got this like metallic voice that you might want to explain away as being some sort of accident, childhood accident, but what kind of accident would cause that? And he says the mask is sort of stiff, you know, that he can't like really emote much, which is going to be a problem when he starts dating Joan again in this new identity. But in the original comic, they didn't care about this. You know, he puts a mask on. It's Mission Impossible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I was thinking this would never work. But, you know, comic books have this incredible magic property where you go, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the artwork tells you it's real, so it must be. And there are no seams. But I like this idea that is not in the original story of him thinking, well, I could take on different identities. Maybe there are stories where he changes the mask to disguise himself. I don't know. But in here, he's thinking, oh, I could have, instead of Paul Dennis, I could have become almost anyone. And he even thinks of, you know, maybe I could have been a black man and maybe I could have been a woman. And
yeah,
that's, you know, a woman, you would have, it's more than just a face, dude. But this
really,
this idea that he could take on different identities. And I don't know how much of that was ever used either in the original stories or even in All-Star Squadron. I don't have any memories of him doing much with that. But in any case, it's the superhero story where you need an alter ego and you'd think brain in a jar, brain in a robot body. Well, that guy's not going to have a secret identity, but they found a way.
Oh, yeah. Easy disguise. That's the way.
I mean, in the stories, he's going to be dating Joan. It's like Joan is very impressed by his. I mean, she did have her problems with Robert Crane, workaholic Robert Crane, missing dates Robert Crane. But she was his fiance. And now, you know, at the funeral, the original funeral is very sad. The original funeral has her and the priest.
Oh, wow.
And that's it.
Oh, that is sad. Oh my god.
Well, I mean, his like Grayson is in jail. Fine, he's got an excuse, but you know, no friends or family or whatsoever. So it's just Joan. Like this comic shows many more people that might have known him, but still, at the funeral or after the funeral, she's already going, I feel randy. You know, this guy's buff. I don't know.
But this guy's buff, but
this guy's cut.
Oh, he can be cut all she wants. I mean, he has no
possibility for consummating their love. I don't know. You know, it's not like Cliff Steele. Like Cliff Steele was trapped in a body not of his own making. So if he wanted something, the chief had to make it for him. But Robert Crane created his own robot body. So if he wanted to modify it in the future for whatever purpose, then presumably he could, so long as you just fit the head on another body or something.
Yeah. I mean, you can probably modify everything.
Untold stories of the Golden Age robot man.
He'll be fine.
Yeah, but it is a weird thing that now this guy is going to be dating his own fiance in another guise while in a robot body. It's a Golden Age idea that is never, you know, never really thought about it as a problem.
Well, for him, it's not a problem. She's still dating him. But for her, I mean, he's a new guy. I guess he's oblivious.
Makes her seem a little callous. It depends how long it takes, you know, in story terms, how long it takes for her to actually become his romantic interest again.
Yeah.
But it's like the body's not cold. So very strange.
Well, I think she was kind of fed up with him before he was Robot Man. She slaps him. Who slaps?
You never been slapped, Bess?
Well, not in that context, no. As a robot, never. Pre-robot best days, not often, but it did happen, I think, once. And I probably deserved it quite a bit.
I don't mean to call you out that way. I've been slapped. So it's not like
I think we all did.
As a teenager, I said something to someone that was misinterpreted. Didn't know the full story, and I cracked wise. And the girl slapped me. Then I realized, I said something triggering. I wasn't thinking in those terms, obviously. That's very much, you know, 2020 speak. But yeah, I've been slapped. Yeah. Not for missing a date or anything.
The way she ends their discussion before he dies, she says, "You can call me in the morning if you still feel like it." I mean, it doesn't feel like their first fight. And she just drives off saying, "But I can't guarantee that I'll forgive you." I mean, she's fed up.
They were on a break.
They were on a break. Yeah, I think they were on a break.
Yeah, and so she feels bad that he dies while they were on a break, on the night of the break. But ultimately, she can move on with her life. And Paul Dennis reminds her of Bob Crane for good reason.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit.
Probably because he is robotic and distant. I wanted to mention, as we move to the action ending, I'll put it up on the site, obviously, but there is a shot of Robot Man outracing a locomotive.
Oui.
And to me, that has to be a wink to Siegel and Shuster.
It has to be.
Because it's not in the original story. Putting it here is saying this was a story by Siegel and Shuster, even though it wasn't Shuster, but Roy Thomas at least thought so. Yeah, that has to be a wink to that. And then we get what did you think of that? I got to tell you, from the original story, that whole car accident bit where, you know, Robot Man jumps out of pretty high-storied building right into the car. And I love how Roy Thomas frames it to say, and he does this a couple of times in the story, where because Bob Crane is a scientist, he can do angles and he knows math and he's actually using his brain, even though the character is a brawny one, like the powers are brawny, but the character is brainy, quite literally just a brain. So that he uses his mind to actually push the limits of the robot body. But this whole thing where the way the car tips and you know, all that accident is way more interesting in the new story. It takes up more space. It's better drawn. It's got more action to it. So it's got a better action finale.
I'm right there with you with the Shuster nods, because I really think that green car really looks like the car from
Action Comics #1.
Yeah, exactly. Really looks like that car also. And it's also a very early Superman move to jump out of a very tall building. I mean, this has Schuster all over it.
That's true. That's true. It is like a Superman story with Joan is going to be Lois Lane.
Yeah, and this is where I really thought it became a Superman story. At this high-paced, action-filled, I really enjoyed that.
There is a thing I want to talk about, which is another nerdiness of Roy Thomas's. That's pretty much my last comment on the issue. And it's, you see at the end, the last page, for some reason, Robot Man thinks of Hawkman and Green Lantern, right? And this is a thing, since you love Hawkman. Hawkman had to appear. This was a nerdy Roy Thomas thing. But Hawkman had to appear in every issue of All-Star Comics. Sometimes he's just like a little picture in a newspaper. Sometimes he's like in the clouds. It's like his head. Somebody's thinking of him. But he had to appear in every single issue. Really? And so this one here where he appears is not necessary because he's also on the splash page. On the splash page, you see Robot Man's future, and you see like Brainwave is on there, and the All-Star Squadron is on there, and Hawkman is part of that. It wasn't necessary to show him again, but I feel like the artist at this point was like, make sure, Hawkman has to be in there. And the reason was that, like, All-Star Squadron is obviously named after All-Star Comics, which is where the JSA had their stories. And Hawkman is the only member to appear in every JSA story.
Oh, wow.
So Roy wanted him to be in every issue of All-Star Squadron for that reason. And I know this because I don't know if he talked about it early on, because I started reading All-Star Squadron towards the last third, I guess. Too young before then, and I just tracked down the other issues later. But I think it's number 49. Number 49 should have had Hawkman's head floating in the clouds as some hero, Dr. Fate or somebody, thinks of him. And it wasn't there. It was supposed to be like a serpent, and the serpent didn't print. So that issue didn't have Hawkman in it. I'm not going to notice. In the letters page about that issue, so like number 53 or something, they reprinted the panel, just the panel in the letters page with Hawkman and maybe like one or two others in the thoughts. And there was an explanation. It said, well, it doesn't really count because that's not the panel that's actually published, but this is what it was supposed to be. And this is the reason why. And it's the reason I just told you about. So Roy Thomas is so freaking nerdy about this stuff. And I'm sure he was, whipping himself that not having made sure that the serpent printed, or he must have been angry at this mistake that nobody but him would have ever noticed. It's like it broke Hawkman's streak of being an all-star. It's ridiculous. But this is a Robot Man story, and yet Hawkman appears twice.
That's quite incredible. And, I mean, he's not going to be the guy who breaks Hawkman's streak.
And by the way, this is a complete parenthesis, and maybe it doesn't fit this particular show, and I should be talking about it in Zero Hour Strikes. But I just read the current Hawkman series by Robert Venditti, and I thought it was brilliant. This is the Hawkman you should be reading. So I might make some arrangements, Bess. We're always trying to force you to read Hawkman comics.
Yeah, I guess to me, Hawkman is like Brussels sprouts. I have to taste it again and again and again and again.
Until you like it.
Just to make sure. Yeah.
But Robot Man, more your cup of tea.
Oh, yeah.
You're into the techie heroes. You like the techie ones.
I like the techie scientific heroes. Hmm. I'm not big, except for maybe Shazam, Captain Marvel. He's probably the only magical, and Superman, I guess. He's kind of magical in a way because his powers are beyond science, But I always liked these techie scientific superheroes. That's why I love The Flash. I mean, The Flash just uses speed in all types of contexts. It uses most of the time actual science. That's how I learned that, to escape Earth's gravity, you have to go Mach 3. I mean, I wouldn't have known that if it wasn't for Flash.
There you go.
You asked me about how I felt about robots. But do you have like a favorite DC Comics robot or a favorite comic book robot?
I don't know. I asked the question but didn't have an answer myself. I think this is it. I think I loved the original Robot Man. I do love Cliff Steele, that Robot Man. So I like Robot Man. And I've seen like various versions. Like in the New 52, they tried to do a new Robot Man. He was like in a sort of anthology kind of comic. And I really like that. So they didn't go with it. They didn't stay with it. It didn't turn out to be anything. You know, I kind of like the Metal Men. Who doesn't? I mean, they're fun. To me, those like those are maybe like the obviously the big ones. I could not care less about Red Tornado. That is that is on record. But yeah, I think what makes a robot like some of these, even all of these, in some way, because even the Metal Men were sort of at some point it was said that they had like the souls or the minds of actual people. Now that's not necessarily the best use of those characters. But I like the robots who aren't robots. Obviously, they're people inside robot shells. I think there's a metaphor to that. That's interesting. Robots themselves, which always kind of turn out to be like sad robots. You know, Red Tornado is like, oh, why can't I be human? Yeah. Like Pinocchio. Exactly what you said. Pinocchio.
Yeah.
I don't like that Pinocchio syndrome thing. I don't care about that. I never have. So I'm not saying like Data on Star Trek was, well, he's not my favorite character. A lot of people love Data. He's not my favorite character. I don't dislike Data. I think, you know, Data was a very effective character and he's built to be loved, you know, to be liked. He has a Star Trek function.
Yeah.
But in comics, I think you sort of need the human mind in there. And even like, if you look at the Metal Men, they're kind of a joke. They're fun, but they're not, like to me, they're not people. You know, they don't feel like people. They feel like they've each got their personality type. And really, that's why you need Doc Magnus in there to be the human who's sort of reacting to them. But they are types. They're not actual people. And I know writers can take them to that place, but that's not really the point of them. And then you got like characters like G.I. Robot. Great idea. Lots of fun. That's not really a person. That's not a character. So when you talk about robots per se, then it's not more like what designs do you like? You know, it's more like which ones are cool, which ones are neat, which ones are silly and fun. But it's not which ones are good characters. The good characters are people. So it's the two robot men principally that fill that niche for me.
Yeah, well, hey, that's great. Personally, I like Kellex, but, you know, I'm a Superman fan. So. Yeah,
cool design, not a person.
Cool design. Or even Skeets.
Skeets, cool design, fun. Not a person.
He's basically a smartphone.
Computo.
Yeah.
Fun. Not a person.
Yeah, exactly.
Superman robots? Stupid. Stupid.
Stupid, yeah.
Okay, so as with, you know, Ryan's Secret Origins shows, he always does a bit about recommended readings. And in this case, it's always very hard with the Golden Age characters because they sort of stopped appearing. And the older stories are very hard to find often, especially these, like Robot Man. There's no, like, Robot Man archives. I don't think.
Yeah.
So they're sort of lost to the ages unless you find scans, and some of them are available online, you know. But what are Robot Man stories that people might like if they want to learn more about the character? It's all in All-Star Squadron, really. He was featured quite a lot. At one point, he had like a jetpack so he could fly. I remember that being equipped. So his story is sort of told there. So if you're going to find any Robot Man, any Bob Crane, Golden Age Robot Man, that's where you're going to have to go. That's what's going to be more available to you. And that's pretty much it, you know. So I got to say, this is only the start of Secret Origins Month. Expect more from various members of the network over the rest of September. Thanks again to our Patreon subscribers who made it possible. If you like this kind of content and want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or monthly donation at patreon.com/FWPodcasts. Because there are always more rewards to unlock. And of course, thanks to you, Bass, for covering this issue with me.
It was my pleasure. I love Robot Man. I love Cliff Steele. And now I love this guy.
You know, you got to invest in some All-Star Squadron. It's in the quarter bins, for sure.
I'll be digging, that's for sure.